Good evening.
Good evening.
Here you are. Here I am again. Yay. And we are 2 days away from the time of the deepest dark of the year. I confess that I have a secret glee that I feel on the time of the deepest dark, because I'm like, oh goody goody, the light is returning. However, I think that that is a bit of a folly to think that. And if I was really wise, I would go, oh good, the darkness. Because the darkness is absolutely necessary. The whole earth in this part of the world is in the wisdom of the darkness at this time of the year. Jean's smiling. It's like, oh good, she finally got here. I've been waiting patiently. You can thank Cauldron. You know, I was out hiking the other day, and you know, the buckeye, I love the buckeye seeds. First of all, you see the buckeye tree and all the leaves are gone now and the branches are all bare, and the seeds are hanging like ornaments on a tree, like the persimmons are too. And then they fall to the ground and they have this amazingly beautiful, you know, this big husk, and the husk opens and then this beautiful chestnut colored object seed is inside, and you know, it finds its way to the ground and it gets the rains moisten the shell, and eventually the shell cracks open and the seed finds its way down into the earth and the roots reach down into the earth. So the darkness is the place where the roots go for nourishment. I mean, I guess there's those little plants that grow in the air, but most plants, most trees wouldn't exist without the nourishment of the darkness and the decay, the rot of the autumn leaves that create the rich soil from which life comes. It's a time, the darkness is a time when we get to rest. I think a lot of the stress of this time of year is how, you know, we, and really in our society, as we live in a culture where we really don't rest. And we don't even have to really have it be dark, because we have lights and we have heaters and we have this go, go, go mentality. And how ironic that this time of year, when the whole earth is going, ah, lay down your weary bones and rest a while, is the time when we're supposed to be the most like up and happy and shopping and, you know, happy. And we're not often. We're in this quiet, deep, dark time, and the discrepancy can be pretty stressful. So, you know, that one of the great, great gifts of our practice in Zen is this quietude. It's the fundamental activity of our practice. We come to the Zendo, we turn down the lights for sitting, so you step into this darkened environment, and then you settle down, and we kind of half close, half open our eyes. So let's do it right now, just for a minute, if you'll indulge me. Go ahead and let your eyes kind of partially close, partially open, not looking around at everybody, making it a little bit darker for yourself. And then just take a few moments to appreciate and feel down with your breath down into the lower part of the body, the hara, that place where our mudra is touching, the place where they say in the Taoist philosophy is the source place, the place where our energy, our qi comes from in Qigong, the Tianpen. Can Can you feel your breath down all the way in the deep pelvic cradle? Can you feel your bottom on the cushion and know that under the cushion is the wood of the tawn, which touches the bamboo floor, and under the floor is the earth? Can you extend your awareness down into the earth, your own roots, and breathe from there? Ah, what a relief. You can open your eyes if you want, or not. What a relief, huh? To just get to settle down for a moment and just be the one that you are. That's the great gift of our practice here. The first book that was published of Dayanand Katagiri's teachings is called Returning to Silence. And in the very first chapter, I think these were Dharma talks, he says, in terms of the universe, or Buddha's I, silence is exactly as it isness, or what is just is of itself. It is very quiet. Buddha's teaching always mentions this. If we want to know who we are and touch the real, silent, deep nature of our life, we must be as we really are. How? Sit zazen. That is all. That is why sitting is very important to us. Our life must be rooted on earth. This is not a particular technique. It is silence. That's it. Silence means you have to be you as you really are. And what a gift I think it is. I certainly experience this in myself. What a gift we give to others when we can listen from this place. When we can speak from this place, from here. You know, sometimes people come and they're like, what'll I do? What'll I do? What'll I do? Oh, I have so many things. What'll I do? What'll I do? It's like, let's get down here first. Let's settle down here in the quietude, the darkness. Now, what was your question? Sounds different if you ask this place to speak. This is one of the early difficult lessons Catherine taught me in her ceaseless critique of my imperfection. She, in addition to always telling me I had to slow down. And like I've said before, the first time she said that to me, I did not literally know what she meant when I was rushing down the path to get to zazen. And she put her arm on me. She says, you need to slow down. And I was like, what is she talking about? And she also used to ask me to consider how much static I created in how I spoke, how disconnected my speech could be from this place. And I'm still working on that. I'm still painfully aware when I speak and I add static, and how different it feels when I take the time to speak from Bahada. Still working on that one, Catherine. Myogen Steve Stuckey, great Dharma teacher who taught in our lineage not so long ago. When he received Dharma transmission, in the lecture that he gave, he said these words. I read this in the Wind Bell many years ago, and I always go back to this quote. I think it's phenomenal. He says, think about Buddha in a radical interior sense as being your own heart, your own innermost request. Buddha is your own desire for complete intimacy and an understanding of yourself and what is around you without anything obscuring it, without any trepidation. Think about Buddha in a radical interior sense as being your own heart, your own innermost request, your own desire for complete intimacy and an understanding of yourself and what is around you without anything obscuring it, without any trepidation. So I think we really know this place. And I think we love this place. Even those of us who feel like, oh, maybe I'm a beginner, or oh, I'm a bad student, or whatever judgment you may have of yourself or your practice, I really do think, you know, if you keep coming back here, I think you know this place, and I think you love this place, or you wouldn't come. There's plenty of other things you can do on a Wednesday night, or on a Monday morning, or on a Thursday evening, then come to this place of dark quietude. And yet, even though we know this place and we love this place, we still get knocked off course. We kind of get hijacked. It's like, why don't we, you know, we touch it. Why can't we stay there? I know that when I really start feeling my mind relax and I start feeling some spaciousness, there's this part of me that goes, oh no, don't think, you know, like it's going to go away. And it does, it goes away. Where does it go? Well, it doesn't really go anywhere. I think that what happens is we just shift the focus of our attention to that little voice in our head. We start listening to it, and it shifts our attention away from that which is always present, from this place of quietude, this hara embodied wisdom. It's not like it goes anywhere, but we go somewhere. We shift our attention. It's like we have a flashlight and we shift it from one place to another. And we shift our attention to, I call it the little voice. I don't know. There's probably some technical Buddhist terms like delusion, or probably some really cool Sanskrit or words for it. But I'll just call it the little voice. Right? Because that's what it sounds like. It goes to the past, right? It ruminates about things that happened in the past, chews on that, or it speculates about the future. It's often a critical or judgmental voice. You're not good enough. They're not good enough. It's not good enough. Oh, if only it was different. Or maybe you have a praising voice. Oh, you're so great. You're so much better than those people. If everybody did it like you, the world would really work. I mean, whatever. You know, it doesn't really matter what the content of the little voice is. The point is that it takes our attention. It dominates our attention. And so I find that I was looking back on many of the talks I've done this year, and I've been talking, I always seem to talk about the little voice at some point during my talks, because I've really been looking at that. I've been thinking, you know, it's really simple. If you can like figure out how to not be so dominated by your little voice, you're going to really get to experience some cool stuff. So I've been inquiring and investigating and studying the subject of the little voice with people. And recently, I had a wonderful experience with a group of wise women studying about the little voice. Now, these wise women happened to be ages 12 to 17. It was pretty amazing. I was invited to return. I had been once before to speak with a high school meditation group. It's like a club. And I don't know why it's all girls, but it is. I don't know if that's by design or if they're just the ones who showed up. But there they are, quite a big circle of young women, and they're ages 12 to 17. So we talk a little bit. We sit about 10 minutes, and then we talk a little bit more, and then the bell rings, and off they go to their next class. So we were talking about the little voice, and we talked about it before we sat, and then we sat for 10 minutes, and then I asked them to report on how'd it go, and how were they practicing with the little voice, and were they able to find a way to somehow shift the focus of their attention to be in the place of stillness and quietude, which we had talked about the last time I had gone there. I called it with them stress reduction and relaxation, because when I asked them what their stresses are, these are all like, it's at this school, they're really good students, because their stresses are all their homework and going to all their activities that they do, and they sounded phenomenally busy, these young women. Anyhow, so here's some of the things they said about how they practice with their little voice. And I'm telling you, and you'll know why I'm telling you after I tell you. So some of them made comments that were of the category of what I would call the let go, the ending delusion approach, right? We vow to end delusion. We're encouraged to let it go, to release the grip. You know, if you study Buddhism, you'll find lots of different ways that we talk about the letting go approach, right? So they said things like, well, I leave it outside the door. We had talked about thinking of it as a roommate. So they were saying, I asked the roommate to wait outside the door. Or another of the young women said, well, that doesn't really work for my little voice because it's really a rebel. And so I have to be much stronger. So I put up a force field. I'm like, okay. She was, you know, that worked for her. So, you know, they were kind of digging into their experience. And so there was the roommate at the door. There was the force field approach. And then a young woman raises her hand and says, well, and I swear I am not making this up. She said this. She said, actually, I have a different approach because it's a part of me, that little voice. And so I really don't think that I want to try to get rid of it because it's actually a part of me. And so what I did was I thought, well, I'll invite it over to sit on my lap. And first I pretended it was a puppy, but the puppy was barking. It was too loud. So I turned it into a kitten. And then I put the kitten on my lap, and I petted the kitten, and it quieted down. I thought, oh, that's like the teaching where we study and become intimate with our delusion, which is another side of our teaching. I've heard Reb gives Tenshin Roshi gives beautiful teachings about becoming intimate with our delusion. It's our family, he says. It's like your family. You try to escape your family, but you can't escape your family. So we open the door and we say, come, come close. So there she was. She turned it into a kitten, and she put it on her lap, and she stroked it as a way to allow herself to then have some opportunity to put her attention on her meditation. So by this time, I'm like writing all this stuff down because I'm going, ah, the wisdom of youth, right? So then another of the young women says, is it okay if I picture myself on a hammock? She said almost apologetically. And I thought about the Buddha. I thought about the story of the Buddha when he was a child. And in fact, in the Awakening Together, the book that we're studying once a month on the third Tuesday, you're welcome to join us if you'd like. It's a book by Larry Yang about the spiritual practice of inclusivity and community. And he talks about this experience of the Buddha, where as a child he was out in the field with his father and the workers who were tilling the field, and As the boy sat in the field, a sense of stillness and peace cascaded into his awareness. And he wondered, am I sitting in the shade of this tree, removed from the distractions of senses and difficult states of mind and heart, allowing the mind to settle into a natural joyousness? Can this be the path that I'm searching for? That's one version. Another version is that he had a little bit of a difficult time watching how the plow was killing the insects as it was tilling the soil to harvest the grain. And at the same moment that he was feeling great compassion for these little struggling insects, he also felt the cool breeze of the blow over, and he felt exquisitely at peace even as he was experiencing this difficulty. So there's different stories about the child, Gautama Siddhartha, just having this direct experience of the peaceful wind, the peace of nature, and the shade of the rose apple tree. And so the story goes that when he was older, and after he left his father's palace and he was striving for enlightenment and was out doing the austerity practice of the time, they say that when he had his, like, wait a minute, this can't be it, starving to death, there's got to be another way, that he remembered then when he was a child and he had felt this exquisite experience of liberation. And so one of the story versions goes that he said, well, wait a minute, if I could feel that when I was a kid, if I experienced nirvana when I was a child and I hadn't done any of these practices, it must be a natural human state. So I'm going to put myself under a tree, like I did when I was a kid, and I'm going to sit here until I have some insight about suffering and liberation from suffering. And they say that was then what encouraged him to have the experience that led him to have the insights that now we call Buddhism. So this idea of, so here's this young woman saying, is it okay if I picture myself on a hammock? And so I told her the story of Buddha as a child. I said, not only is it okay, it's what the Buddha did. And it was the Buddha's instinct that helped him, discover awakening. So, yes, it's a beautiful and it's a natural thing to do. And Larry Yang describes his own experience with this. And I think many of us can relate to this. He says, I remember lying on the grass in the warmth of a sunny day, daydreaming, or maybe day wondering, simply staring into the sky with amazement and openness. I was content to watch the clouds, looking on as scenes and objects and beings appeared, dissolved, and reappeared amid the ever-shifting curves and wisps of white billowing puffs. These early memories are the first time I had a sense of presence, of peace, even if it was fleeting or not fully recognized by me in that moment. We all dream as children. And later he says, whether we are totally conscious of it or not, our spiritual lives begin when we are children. Our spirituality has always been with us, and the seeker has always been present. So I think that this state of ease and relaxation is a very, very natural thing that we actually maybe unlearn as we grow up, as we get the suppressive messages from the adult culture that somehow tell, oh, you lazy bums, get up, or stop playing around, or, all of the things they say, don't be you, don't be, there's something wrong with you. All these messages, and yet here's this kind of original state, that it was just so moving to me to be in the circle of these 12 to 17 year old, people and really hearing it's like they were teaching the Dharma. Those are actually Dharmic practices that they were just naturally connecting to and relating to. And so I was pretty strong with them. I said, don't you let anybody talk you out of the wisdom that you have and what you know, because what you're saying is really, really, really wonderful and really true. So circling back to the solstice then, to the time of darkness. I was thinking this morning about this talk, and as I was thinking about the quietude and the opportunity of darkness, and I was thinking about the wisdom of youth and the naturalness of that state, I remembered one of my first teachers, who was actually my kindergarten teacher. I was really, really, really fortunate that my kindergarten teacher was a profoundly wise human being and a very, very gifted teacher. And I actually think, when I reflect on it, that's why I became a teacher. I mean, I'm a teacher here like this, but before I was this kind of teacher, my first adult job was I was a school teacher. And I actually started teaching kindergarten. I started as a kindergarten teacher down in Watsonville in 1977 or 76, I don't know, something like that. But I wanted to do what she did because I experienced as a child what it felt like to step into an environment where you're welcome, your being is welcomed. It was like a zendo when I was thinking about it that she created. And I had the good fortune that when I was a teacher, she actually became quite famous as a teacher of teachers, and her specialization was children's literature. She became internationally famous. Her name was Kay Goines. I don't know if anybody ever heard of her, but Kay. She used literature as a way to help teachers create these really positive classroom environments in which children could awaken, could experience themselves as the relief of just being the one that they are and being welcomed and appreciated for that. And so today I thought, you know, I'm a pack rat and I save things. And I saved some of the notes from one of the classes I took with Kay because I was remembering this term that she used. And so I brought it because I wanted to share it with you. But one of the things she taught us in this class was she said, this is from my notes. She said, children feel more than they know. Appeal to their feeling level, especially at the beginning of the year. Speak poetry. Give them lines that they can remember. Give them the opportunity to feel what they know and to know what they feel. And then she talked about, and this was the thing that first brought this whole thing back to my mind. She said, you know, there's a subcontinent that exists in children's minds. She called it the blue-black pools of children's mind, impression and sensation, not a place of reason. And especially when you think about five-year-olds, you know, but I don't know exactly at what age the ego really starts to move in. But, you know, certainly up until that point, she talked about this place of impression and sensation where there isn't reason. And she says, literature speaks directly, good literature, good poetry, language that is evocative and deep. It speaks directly to this place, to this blue-black pool. But then she's told us, she says, don't pry into it. She was really big on that's like, leave them alone and let them have their experience. As consciousness rises, then they will offer you their willingness to talk about their experience. So she really believed in just, you know, present this material and just let it go where it goes and don't try to be all, now what did you learn? And give them the comprehension questions, you know, and that kind of adult structure that we put on children. And I'm remembering too, when I was a teacher, I learned how to teach art to children in about 2 hours. Because it was at that time they sent artists into the schools. It was called Spectra. And so we had these really top quality artists who would come and would work with our students and then teach us teachers. So I had this amazing artist who came into my kindergarten classroom. And basically what he taught me is, he said, put out really good quality materials, show them, not give them models about how to paint and how to like copy this and make your thing look like this thing, but show them what the materials can do. Oh, this is watercolor. Watercolor does this. You know, these are pencils. Pencil does that. Give them different kinds of paper. Show them, tack up some really good models of art from multicultural sources and leave them alone. And that's what I did for the remaining 15 years of my teaching career. And you would not believe the stuff those kids produced. And as they were producing the material, we'd put it up and we'd look at it and we'd appreciate it. You know? And it was so original. And it just made my blood curdle when I would, you know, see my well-meaning peers, you know, trying to, here's a box and here's how to draw it, and if don't color outside the lines, and oh, what a mess you made, you know. You know, when I see parents out in the world trying to like squash their children, I'm like, no, no, let them fall, let them get muddy, you know. So I just, this idea of this subcontinent, the blue-black pool in children's minds, I guess I would offer to you that it's, I'm not just talking about children now. I'm talking about us now. I think we have those too. I think we all have these blue-black pools. And again, I think that's one of the beautiful things about our practice is that you do kind of get left alone, you know? We, as Catherine always said, we give you a lot of instruction on how to come in the room and how to get onto your cushion. But once you're on your cushion, the lights go down and we leave you alone. You know, we don't tell you how to do it. You get to use the materials in your own way, right? And then we share. We ask each other questions and we learn together. But there's also this way that we really just allow the experience to be. And I think that's the opportunity of this dark time, this quiet time. You know, when the flowers start coming up and the sun starts coming in the spring, we get all excited and kind of externally focused and projects and all that. That's great, you know, and then we can apply ourselves and do things together just the way that in the classroom. You know, of course we would do reading and writing and arithmetic. You know, it's not like we just all floated in our deep blue pools all the time. But this is the time. This is the time. If we can carve out some time in our busy days to enjoy the darkness. The other thing that I found myself thinking about this morning was brush painting. Because in you know, in the Eastern Chinese, Japanese, but you know, started in China, in the brush painting, and if you've looked at any of the brush paintings that people do, it's as much about the space as it is about the mark. And in fact, I remember a real pivotal moment when I had a high school teacher who took us on a field trip to San Francisco to the Museum of Asian Art, and there was this huge, it was like about 8 panels, and it filled the whole wall of a room, and it was a big series of, you know, one of those brush paintings that kind of unfolds, and there were panels where it was completely blank, and the power of the, you know, the potency of where the mark is put, it's as much about where it isn't, and then the mark itself really brings life to the void. And in Taoism, there's a big strong part of Zen which is really influenced by Taoism. You know, if you like the Sandokai, the merging of difference and unity, and Dongshan's five ranks. that's all coming out of Taoism. And recently I was reminded of the I Ching. Thank you, Patrice, for reminding me of that original friend that I had before I even knew about Zen. But, you know, in the brush painting, it's the same thing, that in Western art we tend to focus on forms, draw the form, draw the tree, right? But in Eastern focus, it's about the space between, within, beyond, and the brush is basically space is awakened by the vitality of the brush. And the experience of the art is as much about the participation of the viewer engaging with this dynamic space and form experience. Just enough form to evoke form. So painting in this tradition then isn't about rendering an object, but it's actually a practice. And it's the practice of connecting our energy with the energy of whatever we're painting. And it's the direct contact with the power of the world that breathes life into our brush. And then you look at those paintings and they take your breath away, because you can feel the energy. You can feel the energy there. So I'm imagining maybe as we leave tonight and as we go off into the busy world. I was just downtown shopping today. I was part of it. There was no parking. All the parking lots were full. And everybody was, you know, if there was a parking lot, it was like this aggressive sort of, it's mine, you know, I'm like, wah. I had to drive way down to the far end of town. And I found a parking place, and then I looked up and there was a sign that said, permit parking only. Dang, you know, so it took like 20 minutes to find a parking place, right? Everybody's down there spending money. And I went there too and spent money. So, you know, as we move in this world, whether we're spending money or not, and going to families, which may be wonderful or maybe not, or the absence of family, you know, it's a stressful time. So may we bring our presence and our practice as a gift to this busy, stressful world that we live in. May we bring this to our families or to the people that we see on the street. May our presence be the present. I wish that for us in this dark time. And yes, then we can celebrate the returning light. I think we'll have a full moon ceremony on the solstice day proper, Friday evening. So if that's not something that you usually do, maybe you'll come this Friday at 5:45 in the evening. There will be a full moon, and that will be when the turning, after that day, then there's 1 minute more of light every day until the middle of summer. You know, we're part of this amazing, big, beautiful dance. And we have our little ceremonies that we do to honor that. So I think I've said all I want to say. I don't know if you have any things that you'd like to say. Edie, yeah.
Well, when you were talking about the children, when Tom and I were hiking in Provence, We stepped into an impressionist museum, and there were 6 to 8-year-olds in a cluster, and they were all circling around a room filled with paintings. And then they were asked to stop and pick the painting that spoke to them the most, and to sit down on the floor with paper and crayons and express what it was about that painting that they really liked, and you know, no instruction how to do that. and they were so engaged. I'm just wondering if there's ever, I've never seen kids do that in a museum here, especially at Pram and the vulnerability of the walls or whatever, but are you aware of that possibility here? It was just so exciting to see that.
I'm sure some people do that. I mean, I don't know as a general practice. I mean, you know, the experience, allowing children to have their experience of beauty and not to get in the way of it, I just found in my own experience, it was amazing what their natural expression was if they were just given enough guidance and then left alone. So I don't know. That sounds like a pretty beautiful thing to see. I know that we're more afraid often in this country. There's seems to be a lot more control of mess and liability and all that. I can't really offer any insight, but how lucky that you got to see that, experience that. Yeah. Anybody else? Any thoughts about darkness or light?
You, at the beginning, you were talking about an inner voice that I think you were describing it as could be sort of disruptive or sort of problematic. And, you know, we often also talk about wisdom or compassion or our deeper nature as an inner voice. And I wonder if you could just share some of your thoughts on that.
Well, to me, there's a real different quality of what I feel is the wisdom voice. First of all, for me, it really, really is more deeply located. I mean, I do love my thinking mind, and I do treasure it, and I do use it. But I also, in my own being, experience that there is a deeper voice than the mind that there's a chattering quality. That to me, the wisdom voice, it's got a different frequency. and I find often that really if I can consciously breathe deep into my body and speak from that place, listen from that place, it has a different quality than the more problematic one. I also think I pay attention to what's the impact of the voice. If it's contractive and, you know, does it make me wince? Does it make me contract? Does it make me close down? Is it making me feel unkind to myself or others? I don't call that wisdom. You know, I do make that distinction. To me, wisdom is wholesome. So, you know, that wholesome, unwholesome distinction from the early teachings. I think that's a kind of a good Geiger counter that that we were given. You know, is the impact of whatever this voice is it wholesome or unwholesome? I don't know. What are you? What's your experience?
Are you using voice as a metaphor? Or are you talking about like hearing sort of like an inner dialogue or inner language or?
I, when I'm being hijacked by my delusion, I'm literally hearing. I mean, I don't know what it's like to actually hear voices, so I don't know if it's like that or not. But I actually hear it. It talks. It's content. It's talking. It's like a station. It's like listening. It's like having a podcast going. And it's literally telling me stuff. It's a script. It's a narrative. It's a story. That's my experience. And it's striking to me. And I know when I first started sitting Sashin, when I started to listen to it, and I'd be like, would somebody please turn that station off? I'm really tired of it. And then it would take me like maybe a day to realize who is it who can turn that station off? And I felt it's actually an intervention. It's an internal intervention. It takes effort, at least for me, because it's strong. It takes effort to say, no, I don't have to think that thought. That was one of my early insights in my practice. I don't have to keep thinking that thought. I will think a thought over and over and over. I will say the same words over and over and over. And when I started to realize the suffering that that was creating, it's like, well, something's got to happen here because it's not really going away on its own. So I'm going to intervene. So it is, maybe that's just because I'm a verbal type. I don't know what others of you experience, but it talks to me. Yeah.
Yeah, for a long time I felt like that's a part of a practice that we don't talk about quite enough, is living from horror. You know, and it's so key to, as you say, you know, to Taoism and to Tai Chi, or to even in the Zen, you know, in Budo, you know, in the martial arts, but also just in, you know, living from, not just getting your mind settled by moving your attention, but literally stepping and moving and living from Hara. Mm-hmm. You know? And I do wish we talked about it a little more, because to me it's, mm-hmm. it's so key. Mm-hmm. And just a point, you know, talk about voice. You said, well, I'm not sure I hear the depth. The thing is that for me, my definition of truth is it's a relative thing, but it means you hear it when what comes out of your mouth is connected. Mm-hmm. Here, there's no break. The same thing with singing. Mm-hmm. If there's a break and it's not coming from mm-hmm. here, from the support. In so many ways, but in acting, you know, for me, it's like if I hear acting that's not coming from here, mm-hmm. it's like, mm-hmm. it's like people mm-hmm. scraping on a,
yeah.
out of a board, you know. But so it's really obvious, just to, you know, to tie that thought up, I for me, it's been a thought and a way of practicing ever since I, you know, was very young, doing martial arts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think too, you know, you can experiment with it. I mean, I've done this with people, like people who come and they come like with a problem, and they're really chewing on a problem, and they're trying to figure it out, and so they're describing their problem. And you know, if we say, you know, you can spend an hour talking about the problem, but you can also, well, let's just for a minute, let's just set that aside, let's stop talking about it, and let's just get quiet together, and let's just breathe together. You know, it's like the same impact of I wrote in that article in that book, Zen for Challenging Times, of, you know, when someone came through the door and was just super emotionally agitated, and it was the same effect of, well, let's just hold each other for a minute. You know, it's kind of the same thing. Let's just stand here and hold each other heart to heart, and let's just breathe down into our bodies. You know, so whether you're touching or you're just not touching, but you're just breathing down and settling down, you know. Okay, now. And then, you know, then what comes out? It's just try it. I mean, try it if you're. It's different. It's different. It comes from a different. And like you're saying, you can hear that. You hear it, and I think that is true. That, you know, when and in theater for sure. Yeah, you feel. You know what? You don't. You feel it. You feel it.
You know it's true.
You feel it. And this is something that I think a gift, again, that we can really give each other is speaking and listening from this place rather than from our thing, right? It's like,
and reinforcing that, just that becomes one of our practices to say, okay, when I, as I'm just experimenting with this, what does it feel like to move my attention mm-hmm. to my belly? Mm-hmm. Now I'm yeah. feeling my belly. I'm feeling it. That's where
yeah.
I am. That's,
yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm feeling this. I'm feeling it. And now I'm starting to act as if I'm perceiving from this.
Yeah.
This is where the world's coming from.
That is a very classic instruction that a Zen teacher gives an agitated student. Put your mind in your mudra. Blanche was the first person who said that to me in my first practice period. Put your mind in your mudra. put your mind in your mudra. It's 7:30, time for tea. So thank you for your attention and for your practice. And we will conclude our 2018 with a few more days of practice together. We'll take a little break and then we'll come back to bring in the new year. So, thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.